Good day, everyone, everywhere, and special greetings to all those seated in heavenly places in Jesus. The name of this broadcast is Cross the Border, and I'm Nicholas, and this is a live prophecy reality edition. And I begin the program that way with that special greetings to all those seated in heavenly places, because that is our position in Christ, is that we are seated in heavenly places in Christ Jesus by faith. And we are the elect, we are the seed of faith, and if you are not, I hope that, well, that you will discover that you really are one of these days. Okay, this is a live prophecy reality edition. I'm Nicholas, and you're listening to First Amendment Radio. We also have the studio cam on, so you can come on over to the chat room at firstamendmentradio.net/chat. I believe that's how it works. And you can join us in the chat room there. And I'll be watching for comments, questions in the chat room, if anyone has any. Today, first hour, news, current events, etc. And in the second hour, we are going to give a couple more installments of the Horae Apocalypticae first volume, and the segments are parts 1 and 2, Intent of the Trumpets, from E.B. Eliot's Horae Apocalypticae. So, and I think that next week, because this week I'm finishing up a series on Genesis that I did, I don't know how many years ago, maybe 15 years ago. I listen and I think, well, because I listen to it, you know, I hear parts of it while I'm working here, and I realize that I wasn't as far advanced in my study of eschatology 15 years ago as I am today, or however long ago it was that I did that series. But everything else is good in it. But I've come a long way in eschatology since then, so just have to take things in the time context that they're given. But that'll be finished this week on Friday. And next week, I think I'm going to actually start playing the Volume 1 of the Horae Apocalypticae, the Audible edition, in my regular broadcast. That'll be 4 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. So if you want to hear the whole thing from beginning to end, then you can start listening. You don't have to listen at the, you know, the 9 o'clock hour when it premieres, okay? You can listen. You have a whole week to catch up until the next week's program overwrites it in the podcast there. And you go to our podcast player, and you can listen to it on your phone, smartphone, at firstamendmentradio.net or .com/MOBI, Mobi, for our mobile page or our web-based cell phone or smart device app. Okay, you don't have to go to the Apple App Store or the Google App Store to get our online app. Let's see, my computer keeps telling me that I'm disconnecting and reconnecting. And there it goes. Oh, reconnection successful. let me know that everything's going all right out there if you're in the chat room. Just give me a thumbs up or some indication that everything's good. And I'll just assume it is unless I hear otherwise. So anyway, that'll be... And then during on the Wednesday program, I'll go back and to do something different for the second hour, because I don't want to do the same thing that I'm doing during the week. But I will start that. I've already begun. I've actually already published that edition of the Horae Apocalypticae on Amazon. You know, the hardback, paperback, and the Audible, as well as the Kindle version. So now I'm working on the second edition, and I've like five segments into it. So I'm anxious, and I'm enjoying reading the book, and I'm enjoying making the audible podcasts of it, because the book, even though I remember everything that I'm reading again, this time out loud for audible, and making edits in the hard edition, the paper edition, that still need to be made, some typos and other stuff, sentence structure, because I have to read it out loud, and sometimes you have to restructure things a little bit different to read them out loud than they are in the book. So it's going to make it very much more readable, because it's a chore for people to read, especially if they buy, because you can buy or you can read, get it free online, a PDF that has the pictures of all the pages, and they have some printers that actually print that in a book, and it's very difficult to read because there's a lot of archaic sentence structure. Some sentences just don't work. There are words that probably have not been used for several hundred years that E.B. Eliot uses. So I always look for an alternate to words that I look at and I go, gee, I have never heard that word in my life. But here it is. So I have to look it up and research it and find a more contemporary word to replace it. So those are the kinds of things that I'm doing. And I actually did, I should look that up during the break and comment on that. So anyway, that's what's going on here behind the scenes at First Amendment Radio. Also, we've lost some support beginning this year, so if anyone wants to step up or change support, if you're already giving as much as you can, which most Christians should be doing, where God wants you to give, then don't change a thing, you know, because we all need to be obedient to God in our giving and in our support of His kingdom. But if there's some questionable things you might want to reconsider giving to, some ministries maybe that you gave to before, and I can't make any recommendations. Like if you're supporting Left Behind or some Rapture ministry, you might want to stop doing that and give it to First Amendment Radio instead. If you're supporting John Hagee, don't do that. If you're supporting anything that's questionable, especially if it's gone woke and gay, you might want to back off from it. And you should always consider or reconsider your giving. Like I was giving to Samaritan's Purse regularly on a month-by-month basis, and I stopped when they put the hospital in New York City, you know, for the COVID thing. But then some emergencies came up, and I know that they are the best ministry organization out there to take care of emergencies and bring the gospel at the same time, because they have accountability, and their accountability says that more of the money that they receive actually goes on the ground where it's given, where it's targeted, than just about any other ministry out there. So like, well, the earthquake came up, I gave to Samaritan's Purse. And then when they had whatever disaster it was last year in America somewhere, I gave, you know, a certain amount to Samaritan's Purse. Or they had the fires in Northern California, I gave there because I know they were on the ground there. And that's where I wanted my money to go, to help those people in emergency. So that's kind of an extra offering when you give like that. But your regular tithing, because you want to discipline yourself enough to regularly give into God's kingdom a portion of your labor. That way, you have people that are vicariously working for you. They're taking your money from your labor and they're applying it. And they're applying it to the ministry on the ground somewhere. So as God's people, we should all already be doing that. And if you're not, well, then you need to take that up with the Almighty yourself. But as it is, First Amendment Radio needs money to operate. Yeah, I work 60 hours a week approximately, or at least, on First Amendment Radio and the other things that I'm doing here that are ministry based. So, and my daughter also works here. and I really can't afford to hire anybody else. That's how things are. But it doesn't matter. It's not by might nor by power, not even the power of money, but by my spirit, saith the Lord. So we are accomplishing what he desires for us to accomplish. Anyway, let's take a look at some headlines. Yeah. Let's see a few things here. Well, I saw this article and I found it interesting. So a little commentary on this one. And this one is from Lou Rockwell, anti-state, anti-war, pro-market. Yeah, that's what, you know, pretty much my view. That would be libertarian, I guess. So I would be a conservative libertarian. If you, politically speaking, conservative, libertarian, Christian, there you go. Have to put all those things together as far as a stance on the political scene. Anyway, why the 1787 Constitution did not bring Republican government to America? And right away you would think, oh, well, that sounds even heretical to say, but it piqued my interest, you know, the name of the article. So I thought I'd read it and I found it interesting. So I wanted to comment on it a little bit. One of the many myths that school children are taught in the name of American exceptionalism is the idea that Americans finally embraced Republican form of government at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. This, we are told, was revolutionary. Now, this guy must be old. Yeah, like I am. Because they used to teach things like this in school, but I'm sure they don't teach anything like this in school anymore. I wish they did, but they don't. But he's saying, and it's true, what he's saying is true, why the 1787 Constitution did not bring us Republican government in America. And I agree with that because I talk about the founding document of America, 1787. America was not founded in 1787. That was actually the second Constitution. The first one was the Articles of Confederation. That was the first constitution, because a constitution is a written document that constitutes the form of your government, okay? So the 1787 constitution that we supposedly have now was not the first document. Anyway, he says the usual narrative goes something like this. In ancient times, the world saw the rise of republics in Italy, Greece. The Roman Republic was notable for its virtue and its status as a government of the people. But the Roman Republic, like the small Greek republics, was but short-lived and was destroyed by the temptations of empire and despotism. Does that sound like something that might be going on today? American empire, a lot of people believe. But the truth is, and that's what I'm going to speak, there is no American empire. It is the empire of the three city states that rule the world that everyone mistakes as being America. Oh, America's doing this, America's doing that. But it's all coming out of the city state of the District of Columbia, which is a city state that is owned and was founded by the Antichrist and his agents, okay? His shadow government, the shadow government that works for the Antichrist. So when people say America did this, well, you have to determine, is he talking about the American people, or are they talking about that enclave over there, Washington, D.C., that is run by the Antichrist and his shadow government, which should not be. And okay, but then came the so-called American experiment, the article goes on. This new noble experiment sprang up when America's great men met at Philadelphia in 1787 to hand down to Americans a new republic, something revolutionary and innovative in the face of a world ruled by crowned heads. This story is often accompanied by a well-worn anecdote about Benjamin Franklin. It usually goes like this, and you probably all heard this too. So did I. I heard this too. Philadelphia, 1787. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention are just leaving Independence Hall, having decided on the general structure for the new United States. of that Constitution. A crowd had gathered on the steps of Independence Hall, eager to hear news. A sturdy old woman, sometimes referred to as an anxious lady, wearing a shawl, approached Benjamin Franklin and asked him, "Well, doctor, what do we have? A republic or a monarchy?" And Franklin replied sagely, "A republic, if you can keep it." Yes. I don't know if that's a true story or not, but that's something that I've heard before, and it goes around. Okay? Most of my readers will surely have heard this little anecdote many times. The subtext here is that the United States had invented something altogether new with the Constitution of 1787. The story suggests that in the late 1780s, Americans were not yet sure if they had the fortitude for a republic or if they would return to being a monarchy. Fortunately, the sagacious founding fathers decided we would be republicans after all. As propaganda, this story has been remarkably effective for many Americans, at least for those who receive some sort of education. The propaganda seems quite plausible. After all, weren't the French and the English ruled by despotic kings in the late 18th century? Wasn't George Washington offered a position as King of America? Apparently, whether or not the United States would be a republic remained an open question. It's a nice tale, but it is fundamentally wrong in light of the political realities of the 1780s. This is obvious when we consider two facts. The first is that by the time the 1787 convention took place, the lands of the former British colonies were already a thoroughly Republican place. All of the U.S. states, plus the neighboring Republic of Vermont, had adopted Republican constitutions. The Philadelphia Convention had nothing to do with it. The second problem for the myth is that in 1787, the United States overall already had a Republican Constitution. The so-called Articles of Confederation had been adopted in 1776, and thus there was nothing revolutionary or innovative about adopting a second Republican Constitution in 1787. In other words, all Americans in 1787 already lived in a constitutional republic at both the state level and the federal level. So no, the founding fathers most certainly did not invent or create a new experiment of republicanism in any way. They knew the new thing that they were trying to do was carry out a counter-revolution and superimpose a large and expensive national state apparatus over the American republics that already existed. This new government would impose taxes at higher rates than the old monarchy ever had. Unfortunately, the counter-revolutionaries succeeded. And I believe this is true, and I believe that the counter-revolutionaries worked for the Antichrist and his shadow government. And F. Tupper Saucy clearly exposes that in his book, Rulers of Evil. And the author goes on here, but why invent a myth in which the new Constitution was somehow responsible for making the United States a republic? At least part of the motivation here surely stems from the fact that the myth minimizes the state's role in creating the republic by ignoring the fact that the states laid the groundwork for republican government. The myth can instead push the narrative that the Federalists, see, I would be an anti-Federalist if I were in that day, and I'm an anti-Federalist today, to tell you the truth, so you could add that to my list of libertarian, conservative, Christian, anti-Federalist. Yes. They gave America, yes. See, by ignoring the fact that the states laid the groundwork for a Republican government, the myth can instead push the narrative that the Federalists and their strong new central government gave America a Republican form of government. Nonsense. This top-down creation myth erases the bottom-up reality. There it is. This top-down creation myth erases the bottom-up reality. Moreover, the myth helps to obscure the fact that the United States was originally intended to be a voluntary confederation of republics and not simply a republic. And that question was settled in the Civil War, by the Civil War. Yes, because they were not voluntary after the Civil War. And I believe that's why nobody's attempted to leave to this day, because of the Civil War and the tyrant Abraham Lincoln. Yet the myth endures. The states were already Republican before the new Constitution. Yeah, figure that out. The reality of America's earlier Republican origins is, ironically enough, related by Federalist John Adams. While he was America's ambassador in London in the 1780s, Adams began to work on his tome, A Defense of the Constitutions of Government of the United States of America. This was completed before the Philadelphia Convention, and it was not written to defend the new 1787 Constitution at all. Rather, Adams wrote the book to defend America's state constitutions from claims, largely, that the state constitutions weren't sufficiently Republican. Adams contended that the state constitutions were indeed Republican, and he addressed these charges with extended discussions of what qualified a polity as a republic. And the article goes on. Great article there at LouRockwell.com. And one of the reasons that I bring up this article, because I believe that if there's any hope for America in the governments that are here, and there's little, but I think there's enough that can save America until Christ comes from total despotism. I mean, we're already in a state of a lot of despotism, a lot of corruption going on, but as with a few other commentators out there, like David Knight and some others, I agree that we need to get back home, and people need to get engaged in their local governments at the local level, counties and states, and look to preserving what liberties they have in their states and their counties that they can, because the federal government, as it is constituted and where it is constituted and centralized in Washington, D.C., seems to be totally under the control of the Antichrist and whatever puppets that he, by his corruption, can pay off to do his will. Because the Antichrist must have the money power, and believe me, the Antichrist does have the money power. So, yeah, there's nothing to show here, this says. Okay. So that's how Washington, D.C. works. It works by money power. And whoever controls the money, well, pretty much rules the world. But when we talk about ruling the world, we're not talking about true rule. We're talking about the rule of men and the governments of men and those beast governments that even the Bible outlines as being real in the world. And I tell you, going through E.B. Eliot's Horae Apocalypticae brings the whole picture into view, and the reality of what's going on becomes so much clearer. So anyway, we're going to get into more news and headlines when I get back from these messages. So don't go anywhere.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe, so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back. You're listening Across the Border. This is a live prophecy reality edition. And when we left, we were talking about an article I found. Well, there's another article that is fitting while we're on the theme, I would say. This one, also from LouRockwell.com. Absolutely worthless and criminal are the Constitution, conservatism, liberalism, voting, and the government. A man's natural rights are his own, against the whole world, and any infringement of them is equally a crime, whether committed by one man or by millions, whether committed by one man calling himself a robber or by millions calling themselves government. Yes, true words. Let's see, get this article over here, I can see it. That's from Lysander Spooner. It is time to put to rest any false notion of government reform, of any and all government laws, of the total fraud of voting, of constitutional rights, which do not exist, and of all government itself. Yes, this is a long overdue diatribe for all those who continue to think and do the very same things over and over, expecting to gain a different outcome. I believe that this is the definition of insanity, and for a very good reason. It is. I mean, like a lot of people thought in 2016 when they voted for Trump that he was going to save the world. Well, everything was going fine until 2020 early, when he did the worst thing that had been done to America in a long time. And he locked us down and let the globalists have their way in his government. Was he a dupe? Was he a fool? Was he fooled? Was he deceived? None of that matters. What matters is what he did. And would he do it again? Maybe for the same reason. And, you know, I think, yeah, I agree with this article here, and maybe for other reasons also, because I believe, if you'll remember, Donald Trump was intent on releasing the JFK files, you know, those classified documents about the assassination of the president in the 1960s, 1963 to be exact. Yes, I think I'll never forget that year and when that happened. It will always be fixed in my mind. I was 10 years old at the time, so anyway. But he was going to release documents, and I pondered this a little bit. Why didn't he do it? He was intent on doing it. And who stopped him? Would he have done it? Well, yes, I think he would have done it. And I think he was stopped by the people that were responsible for it. And I think this is kind of how it goes. He had a meeting with some people, perhaps, that he never met before, or maybe saw in passing, never knowing who they were or their importance. But he learned that they were representing people that he didn't know who they were or that they existed, but they were part of a cabal, a shadow government that was really ruling in Washington, D.C., behind the scenes, a ruling class that does not like the light of day. They do not want to be publicly outed for who they are. Yeah, that's the best way to rule if you can, because you don't have to take responsibility for anyone, and the people don't come and burn down your house. Hey, when things go wrong, as they usually do. But they probably had a little meeting with him. Because, I mean, what is the meeting about? Well, it's about releasing the truth and all of the classified documents surrounding a president that was assassinated. And if these documents were released, it would become evident to all who was really operating and working things behind the scenes. And those people that are still operating the shadow government behind the scenes, they do not want to be seen for who they are. That's why they're hiding. And what would they say to someone like Donald Trump? You know, they might say, "And we did it." Yeah. "And we did it. And we can do it to you too. And if that's not enough, we can do it to everyone you love first." That's right. I mean, they can assassinate people openly. I mean, didn't we just lose for two Republican senators, congressmen or state representatives that just killed, shot to death, here recently, over the last 6 months or something, just for being who they were? Republicans getting in government and wanting to do the right thing. Yeah. So, and they probably point out, "Look, we did him, we did him, we did him. You see how well we covered it up? And don't think that you would be a problem for us either." Yeah. I think that goes on behind the scenes. For every president at some occasion in his presidency. And either he will go along or he won't. So, I mean, under these circumstances, could there ever really be a truly elected president in the United States, a guy who really did no wrong in his life, just a regular guy, you know, get in there and think, "Well, I'm going to be president and I'm going to straighten it out"? Well, he's delusional. He just doesn't know he's delusional yet. And why should he believe he's delusional until he gets in there and tries to do something like release these documents and for the world to see, to expose the shadow government that killed that president and has killed many other people? They have no compunction. The shadow government has no compunction about killing people. It's just that they don't like to make martyrs either, because they understand how the world really works. After all, they've been in the shadows for a long time operating their shadow government. And you could say, "Well, I'm a conspiracist theorist. Yes, another conspiracy theory. Well, it's not a theory if it's fact. And it is, yes, it is conspiracy. Because they have conspired. I've read their documents. And they have conspired to do what they are doing. And most of the world will never see it. A few will hear it and know the truth." It's like this book here, The Horae Apocalypticae. I'll tell you what, all of that nonsense out there and all the debates on prophecy and Bible prophecy out there, they're all settled right here. The fact is that most people will never read this book. They'll never have the time to sit down. They will judge it before they read it, and therefore won't read it because they've judged it not worthy of their time. But anyone who's read this whole book will know that it is the truth, because then they will become a historicist. And not only when you read history, because, you know, two of my favorite books, I have to admit, two of my favorite scholarly works are, one, the Horae Apocalypticae, and the other one is James A. Wiley's History of Protestantism. One looks at the history of the church from the beginning, okay? The history of Protestantism as it developed out of that history of the church from the beginning. And the other one correlates that history of the church with the prophecy that God gave of the future in advance. And he marks it. And it is, if you read it and you understand it, it becomes undebatable. Not a debatable point at all. Because I'm just going through volume 2, getting to the Reformation, and how beautifully pre-pictured in the Apocalypse, in the Revelation of St. John, and how exacting sometimes every word in a sentence is, how exacting the Spirit of God was, and how marvelous his prophecy was, and how it played out in the history to follow. Everything else is just confusion. If you cannot relate the prophecy from the time that it was given, and John wrote, that those things must shortly come to pass as to their commencement, the future things that would commence immediately and play out over our, you know, over the past 1900 years of history. And here we are today. We're getting to the end of this era, the era before Christ returns. Yeah. And there are many other good works out there, but if you really want the complete picture, James A. Wiley's History of Protestantism and the Horae Apocalypticae. And the Horae Apocalypticae, you can read it for free on at horaeapocalypticae.wordpress.com. Okay? You can read it for free. Also, like I said, starting Monday, I will be playing the Audible version because I have completed the entire first volume, and I'm working on the second volume right now, the Audible version. And so you can hear the whole thing. You can even go to our archive page there and download those MP3s and save them if you want. I mean, you know, that's up to you if you want to do that extra work to save them. Or you can purchase them from Amazon or from First Amendment Radio. If you'd like to give a donation to First Amendment Radio, send us a donation by the mail, cash, check, money order, gold and silver, whatever. Just mail it securely and ask for the entire Audible version of the Horae Apocalypticae Volume 1, and I'll send it to you. Just tell me how you want it sent. We can do it digitally, or we can send it on a DVD, a data DVD, if you want that. Okay? So, if you're interested, I'm interested in sharing it. But, like I said, you can get it free by listening starting Monday. And it will be play for 2 hours or four segments each day until it's all done. And then, of course, there will be a time when we do Volume 2, Volume 3, and Volume 4, Lord willing. And the sun don't stop shining, especially for yours truly. I will complete the work that I've begun as he completes the work that he has begun in me. Okay. So anyway, another good article there. Any praise whatsoever of government, any government is blatantly absurd and ludicrous on its face. My feelings, exactly. Government and the state are the essence of vast criminality and gang violence, far worse offenses than any common criminal or gang of common criminals could commit. This is not arguable throughout the entire course of history. What is even more disturbing is that in every revolution, every major act of dissent, every protest against the state, and during the whole of every period in history, every time a current sitting government is negated or ousted, the masses put into place another government expecting things to be better this time. It never has been in the thousands of years, but the mass of humanity disregards this fact and attempts to gain freedom by voluntarily creating or allowing another government master to rule them. The very idea of this is mind-boggling to any intelligent individual, of which apparently there are too far few. And those are true words. This is a very extremist liberal position here being exhibited by, who is this, by Gary Barnett on LouRockwell.com, and the article is called "Absolutely Worthless and Criminal Are the Constitution, Conservatism, Liberal Voting, Liberalism Voting, and the Government." Good article, very thought-provoking, and I think that's really the reason for it, because we will never have good government, and that's the truth, because as long as we have evil, infallible men, especially as the majority on the planet Earth, the best we can hope for is a government that we can easily live with, which we've pretty much had over the last, 100 or so years in America, on and off, mostly on for my lifetime, easy to live with. And there are things that make it easier to live with a tyrannical government, even as the one I've had during my whole lifetime. They've imposed things during my lifetime that were not imposed before, and I refuse to participate in, like socialist security and socialism. Everyone volunteers for it. Many people mistakenly believe that they're required to participate in a lot of things that they're not required to participate in, but that is the impression that the shadow government wants to give people or teach children as they're coming up in the public schools, so that they believe a lot of lies. They believe that they have to do things that they don't have to do. They believe the things that are required that they don't have to do. Yes. See, someone said, what does E.B. Elliott predict? Here it is here. And this from someone without a name. It says, hello, Farr. What does E.B. Elliott predict yet to come in the Revelation? Well, the same things that the Revelation predicts yet to come. We have more of the same. We have developing and what will be an enforced mark of the beast on the world. And it will be varyingly enforced in different places in the world. That's why I say we must continue wherever you are in the world, to protest and resist, even to the death, if you must. But I think one of the biggest events that will be most marked, that has yet to come before Christ comes, will be the destruction of the seat of Mystery Babylon. Something is going to happen for the shadow government to be outed, and it's going to become apparent to the governments of Western Europe. And I think that could be developing right now, as the governments, the people of Western Europe, what constituted the old Western Empire, the ten-horned beast, the ten horns being the ten divisions of Western Europe, are going to turn on the little horn power. And the little horn power refers to Rome as a ruling power, which would at this time be the Vatican. So we look to see the destruction of the Vatican. The Bible leaves it no uncertain terms that the Vatican, as the head of Mystery Babylon that rules the world right now, will be raised to the ground. So that's one event that we have to look forward that will be very notable between now and the return of Christ. So Christ is not going to return until that happens. So I hope that answers your question there from the 440 area code. I'd like to get names from people when they text me, so I at least have something or some kind of nomenclature. But I hope that answers your question. And you can say yes, or if you have another question, please feel free to text me. We have a text number for First Amendment Radio. It's 559-543-8470. So, and I get a notification immediately if I get a text. Okay. Anyway, thank you for that question. That's a question that many people have. And I thought maybe I need to study a little deeper, especially after going through the Hoary Apocalyptic. I'm going to look, do maybe a special study on that. Maybe that's what I'll start to do for my second hour on Wednesday after this, after I start airing the audible version of the Hoary Apocalyptic the rest of the week. Maybe we'll just look into and try to get a little deeper into some of the details of what has yet to happen before Christ comes. But to me, in my way of thinking, and without really looking at it in depth, I think that would be the most notable event that we would look for. So, and you can see everything's kind of seems to be moving in that direction, because, America, or I should say Washington, D.C., the Antichrist agent, Joe Biden, he blew up the pipeline that belonged to Germany and Russia. And the Germans weren't happy about that. But the reason that he did it was because the German people were saying, we want our gas. We're tired of this. So the people are getting tired in Western Europe. And I think it's going to be some kind of event. Maybe the Vatican will start bragging, or maybe they'll show their cards or whatever. Something is going to happen where they're going to see it, and somebody's not going to be happy about it, and the Vatican is going to be destroyed through some kind of instrumentality over there. How this will exactly play out, well, we're not getting those details, but that, I believe, is what we're looking for. Anyway, we're coming on the end of the hour here, and I hope this has been an edifying and eye-opening hour for you out there. Any more questions or comments, I'd be happy to address them for you. Let's see, what else do we have in a few more minutes that we have here? Let's see. Ilhan Omar withdraws support for East Palestine after learning it's in America. Some more woke Babylon Bee for you. Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that people like this are in the government in America. I would have never believed it 20 years ago, but today it's like anything goes. You got this other guy. What is his name? Where's that guy at? No, that's not. Oh, this guy here. Pete Buttigieg. I think the G is silent on the end, so it's Buttigieg. Yeah. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Please correct me if I got that wrong. Pete Buttigieg promises to investigate Ohio railway chemical spill for signs of racism. I mean, that's what the Antichrist is doing in Washington, D.C. So when everyone's going pointing at America, or you listen to some of these broadcasters and go, America's the most, the worst people, and you know, we're important. No, it's not America. It's the evil people in America. It's Washington, D.C. is not America, as far as I'm concerned. It's not one of the 50 states. It belongs to the Antichrist. It's his. He imposed it on us, practically speaking. The ones who were against it, really, they were lucky to get that Bill of Rights in there, because believe me, the Antichrist did not want that Bill of Rights as part of the government of the United States. That wasn't included in the Constitution that was laid out before those men. But the Bill of Rights was attached to it and is an integral part of the Constitution. It's not something that you can change. Those first 10 Bill of Rights are non-negotiable, unchangeable. But in order to change them, they've now added to them 11, 12, and up to 20, whatever they have now. And they've even repealed some of those that they added on. So they've set up the framework to repeal our basic, those 10 basic Bill of Rights, which they have not done yet. And as long as we have those, we need to exercise them, no matter what the cost. And even if the government does not honor them, which they are not doing, we still need to resist. Resistance is not futile, and we must resist to the very end. Your name and where you're calling from, I have 1 minute.
Yeah, Bill from Ohio. I liked your JFK explanation. No, we're not going to release the men. We'll do it to you.
Yeah.
Well, basically, the reason why they didn't release the JFK tapes is they told them what they'd do to him if they did.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Rulers of evil, basically everybody's hands are tied. What can you do?
That's right. Well, that was the conclusion that he came to by the end of the book. Yeah. And then I'm telling you, that's all we can do is resist where we're at and continue to resist until Christ comes.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate all right, Bill. Thank you. I'm out of time. All right, and I am out of time. My tone just went off. Next hour, we will be jumping into the exposition of the Hori Apocalypticae, those two segments that I referred to earlier. All right, I thank everyone for showing up, and I'll be back to introduce those two segments, so don't go anywhere. Hi, I'm Nicholas Arthur, and I'd like to introduce you to my latest book. Reformed Prophecy Interpretation, an apology for Reformed premillennial historicism in the 21st century. As with primitive biblical Christianity, historicism is the method of prophecy interpretation restored with the advent of the Protestant Reformation, and had become so widely held that for a long time it was called the Protestant view. My book is not so much about the errors of dispensationalism or amillennialism. Rather, it is about the historicist alternative to understanding many of the same passages from the vantage point of prophecy fulfilled in history. For those that desire more than mere hypotheses, bolstered with conjectured speculation, those who require explicit biblical exegesis and verified historical fulfillment, and are not willing to accept speculation as anything other than what it is, speculation, not truth, this book is for you. Over the last century, this method of interpretation has become almost completely forgotten, even by Protestants, in the face of a method that is based almost entirely on future speculation, rather than fulfilled prophecy in history. In my book, I examine the reasons for this and investigate some of the prophecy which has been fulfilled in the interim, as well as present an apology for Reformed premillennial historicism to the 21st century. If you're interested in a copy of my book, you can go to my website, crosstheborder.org, and get more information there. Or you may also find it at Amazon. Okay, well, we're back here after a false start. Well, welcome back. You're listening to Cross the Border. This is a live prophecy reality edition. And in this hour, we are going to play a couple installments of E.B. Eliot's Hoary Apocalypticae. And as you can see, this is from Volume 1. And the segments are, let's see, The Intent of the Trumpets, from Part 2 and Chapter 2, The Intent of the Trumpets. That's two parts, so will perfectly play out in this hour. You can read it for yourself, and I suggest that everyone, if you're interested in prophecy at all, you should read the entire Hoary Apocalypticae yourself. It's well worth the effort. You might have to read it a couple times to really get it. I know it's a lot, but why waste your time on anything else? Either read it or forget about prophecy altogether. Just live your life the best you can and obey the Lord Jesus Christ. We should all be doing that anyway. But go to hoaryapocalypticae.wordpress.com and you can read this one for free there, because it's all on that page, except for some of the appendices are not there. But you'll be lucky to get through the volume of the books itself, let alone the appendices, unless you're an avid reader like I am. And you can actually buy paperback copies there if you're so inclined to sit under your light at night and read for a couple hours before you hit the sack. Anyway, without much further ado, let's jump into those several segments here. Let's see. Hoary Apocalypticae, Volume 1, an historicist commentary on the Revelation, updated and revised for the 21st century, derived from the original work of E.B. Eliot, and read by yours truly, Nicholas Arthur. Part 2, Chapter 2, Intent of the Trumpet Sounding, and Expository Principles of the First Four Trumpets. Roman numeral 1. Preliminary to our inquiry into the principles to be followed in our exposition, more particularly of the first four trumpets, it may be well to premise a few remarks on the general significance of the apocalyptic symbols of the trumpets, and the septenary number of the soundings on which the judgments foredoomed were to be successively poured out on the Roman earth. an inquiry this that cannot but be useful and interesting. For since we are told that it was by God's own appointment that trumpets were made and used in ancient Israel, as also that their uses were all expressly defined by him, and these uses of them to be made in the Jewish temple by the priests that stood before God. And since in the vision of Patmos, the apocalyptic temple was similarly the locality of the trumpet blasts, and the trumpet angels similarly designated as those that stood before God, therefore we are right in supposing an analogy between the two, and that a significance attached to the trumpets in the latter case, not dissimilar from that attached to them in the former. Now under the Levitical law, the use of the priestly trumpet may be classed as twofold. First, and as regards the Israelite, its use was to proclaim to them the epoch of advancing times. The Sabbaths, the new moons, the new years, and the festivals, on these summoning the congregations for praise and prayer. Beside that, it served also, while they sojourned in the wilderness, to proclaim each forward movement of the camp, and thus to note their advancing steps toward the end of their pilgrimage. Second, during wartime, and as regards their enemies, its use was to proclaim war against those enemies, as from God himself, the trumpets blown by his priests against them being a declaration that the Lord had taken up Israel's cause as his own, and that he would fight for Israel. And it seems to me that of these two kinds of uses, we may apply not the one only, but both, to the emblematic trumpet sounding in the apocalypse, to his own Israel, to the 144,000, emerged indeed out of the Egypt of pagan oppression, but having still the tribulation and long pilgrimage of the wilderness to pass through, each trumpet sounding like the hour striking on a chronometer, might be regarded as a chronological epoch in the prophecy, a note of advance toward the promised blessed consummation. Such, for instance, is the chronological use made of them in the vision of Revelation 10, in which vision the sun-beaming angel that descended and stood with his feet on land and sea, when he would distinguish the true time of consummation from the wrong, thus expressed his meaning, he swear by him that live for ever and ever that, not in the days of the sixth trumpet angel, under which his descent took place, but in the days of the seventh, the mystery of God should be finished. This, I say, was one thing signified to St. John by the successive trumpet soundings, and as to him, by the figurative trumpet blasts. Likewise, was it signified to the saints from time to time living, in so far as understanding on the subject might be given them, by the voices of the actual events prefigured as they in sequence sounded upon a startled world. Further, since during all this time there was a state and a people in open opposition to the truth and the true Israel, therefore the successive trumpet soundings might be considered also as the repeated proclamations of war from the Lord himself against them. Indeed, this is the meaning most prominently marked in the trumpet soundings of the apocalypse, as it is the use most frequent of the figure in other scriptures. And let me add that supposing the trumpets to have been blown in the temple of vision, like those in the ancient temple of Jerusalem, over the burnt offerings and peace offerings on the great altar, then it must have looked like an intimation that the cause thus espoused by God was espoused as the cause of those who had made a covenant with him by sacrifice, and as against them especially that had forsaken the holy covenant associated with that mystic altar and its one great sacrificial offering. Seven trumpets were to be sounded, and under the seventh trumpet, seven vials poured out. The numeral resemblance of these to the seven trumpet blasts sounded on seven successive days against ancient Jericho, and which were followed on the seventh day by seven marchings around its wall, till on the last day the wall fell down, and entrance was given to Israel into that first city of the promised Canaan, this interesting resemblance, I say, has been noted by Ambrose Ansbert in old times, and in more modern times by Vitringa and others after him. It almost seemed as if some power were marked out thereby as the New Testament Jericho, whose domination opposed and whose overthrow would introduce the saints' enjoyment of the heavenly Canaan. And if so, what power but that of the then nearly dominant anti-Christian apostasy? It is observable, and perhaps confirmatory on this view, that in the ancient Jewish Feast of Tabernacles, there was kept up a constant commemoration of the above-noted manner of the fall of ancient Jericho, and this with a certain reference to the future, in the ritual, as well as to the past. On 7 successive days, according to the divine ordinance, a palm-bearing procession with trumpets blowing were then wont to visit the temple, and on the last of the 7 times to compass the altar, still sounding the trumpets and chanting Hosanna. Now as the cry Hosanna was supplicatory, signifying save now, as in Psalm 68:25 addressed to Yahuwah, it seemed to refer to some enemy yet to be conquered by Messiah for his people, some Jericho yet to be overthrown. Many a time must St. John himself have witnessed the celebration of this ceremony. And thus, when he saw prefigured the rising up and reign of an earthly anti-Christian power, to which the duration meted out was that of the 7 trumpet soundings, and under the 7th trumpet of the 7 vials pouring out, the remembrance of it and the application could scarce fail to strike him. Of the fall of the first, or Canaanite Jericho, the commemoration was in that Jewish Feast of Tabernacles of which I was just speaking. Of the fall of the second, the celebration was to be in the anti-typical Christian Feast of Tabernacles, yet future, that same festival that St. John had just before seen anticipatively figured in the palm-bearing vision, and to which the eyes of the saints have ever since been directed, as the destined term of all the evils and all the enemies of the wilderness. Roman numeral 2. But now as to the interpretive principles, more particularly of the 4 first trumpets. The sacred narrative respecting them and the figurations that ensued on their several soundings are as follows. The angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar and cast it into the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. And the 7 angels which had the 7 trumpets prepared themselves to sound. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood. And they were cast upon the earth, and a third part of the trees was burnt up, and all the green grass was burnt up. And the second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and a third part of the sea became blood, and a third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed. And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers, and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became wormwood, and many men died of the waters, because they were made bitter. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and a third part of the moon, and a third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. Revelation 8:5-12. The first 4 trumpet visions, it will be seen, like those of the first 4 seals, are connected together by certain strongly marked features of resemblance, and which are here of such a nature as to make it desirable to consider the 4 together. They depict the destructive action of a series of tempests, successively affecting the third part of the Roman earth, third part of the sea, and third part of the rivers, and a third part of the firmamental luminaries. by English Protestant interpreters, they have been generally explained, and I doubt not truly, of those successive invasions of the ravages of the Goths, chiefly in the 5th century, which ended in the subversion of the Western Empire. At the same time, there has been, as to the details, and the apportionment of its part of the Gothic ravages to each one of the four trumpets distinctively, such a remarkable difference of opinion, scarcely two commentators explaining them alike, as to have thrown discredit, in the opinion of not a few, on the Gothic application altogether. Nor is the want of distinctness less marked in the expositions of German or other expositors, who take quite a different general view of the prophecy. Hence, a necessity, evidently, that the principles on which we are to form a distinctive and particular application of the several figurations should be carefully inquired into and established. I said that of the general truth of the Gothic application of these four, I have no doubt. And on the question whether they were so intended or not, the reader, whosoever may have thus far followed and agreed with me, will, I think, soon see reason not to hesitate. Considering that we were brought by the visions of the first six seals to that period of Roman history when paganism fell and Christianity was established under Constantine and his successors, and that the six seals' closing figurations on the four threatening, but temporarily arrested tempest angels, and the sealing and palm bearers fixed our position at Theodosius's arrest of the Gothic insurrection under Valens and the contemporary Augustinian revelation, an arrest of which the sudden ending at Theodosius's death might seem to mark a new and fateful epoch, just such as to answer to the seventh seal opening, considering, I say, that in comparing the parallel course of the prophecy and the history, we were thus brought by the apocalyptic visions to the precise epoch of the commencement of the great Gothic eruptions into the Roman Empire, and that then the symbols in the vision next following were such as well to suit those Gothic devastations, being the symbols of thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake, then, after trumpet soundings from on high, those of tempests, volcanoes, meteors, successively bursting on the Roman earth. It seems to me almost impossible to doubt but that the latter were intended as a prefiguration of the former. There are two further coincidences that must not be omitted as furnishing corroborative evidence of the truth of this conclusion. The one is that the Gothic ravages terminated in the extinction of the Western emperors and empire, so that the fourth trumpet vision, the last of the series, depicted the partial darkening of what were well-known symbols of rulers, the sun and heavenly luminaries. The other, that as the Gothic desolations were succeeded by, after a half-century or more interval, the Saracen invasions, so the fourth trumpet vision was succeeded after the forewarning notice, which might well correspond with that interval, by the fifth trumpet vision, a vision almost demonstrably figurative, as I hope to prove, of that very Saracen woe. Which point being settled to our satisfaction, we come next to the question of the right particular application of each of the four visions to the one particular eruption of the Goths indeed corresponding. For that some such particular application is intended, and that distinctive marks are given in the visions to fix it, I cannot doubt. The divine selection of the symbols, being the best possible, require our assurance a priori, must be precise and distinct, and their precision and appropriateness in every one of the apocalyptic visions that we have hitherto considered has very strikingly illustrated and confirmed the fact. The only doubtful question is as to the distinctive mark intended. The question is narrowed by the important fact, to which notice has already been called, of the fourth vision of the series almost obviously prefiguring, if the general reference be admitted, the extinction of the Western Caesars, so that it is only in the cases of the former three that we have need to seek out the distinctive characteristics. And thus, with this view, as the reader considers the three trumpet visions in question, there may be, and probably is, something partially characteristic of each particular invasion in those of the symbols, respectively, that prefigure the powers invading, I mean the hailstorm, the volcano, and the blazing meteor. Yet, that the measure of similarity of character between them, as being all alike figures of hostile and desolating armies, is such as to preclude them from furnishing any decisive distinction. And thus he finds himself forced to look to other stated particulars in these several visions, for the marks he is in search of, especially to their designations of the locality or geographical division in each case invaded, the which, indeed, from the singular and marked character of the phraseology that defines them, appear expressly intended to fix the attention of the reader. The third part of the trees, land. The third part of the sea, the third part of the rivers. But behold, commentators of high name interpose, and tell us that there is nothing of local or geographical meaning in these expressions, that they are all mere figures. The Roman universe, says Mead, as he is followed in the spirit of his exposition by many subsequent English expositors, is compared to the mundane system, which consists of earth, sea, rivers, heaven, stars, the system or constitution of the empire having, as its earth, that which is the base and foundation, as it were, of the whole polity, as its sea, that amplitude of rule which circumscribes its earth, as the natural land is circumscribed by the natural sea, its political rivers also, which originate from and flow into the sea, vis-a-vis the provincial magistrates, and etc. And then, as to the third part, whether of land, sea, or rivers, he expounds it to mean the whole Roman earth, as constituting, he says, about one-third of the then-known world at the time of the evangelists. Who can wonder that by interpreters who have adopted any such principle of interpretation, the visions of the three first trumpets should be applied with equal facility and plausibility to one as to another of the Gothic invasions? For the very distinctness of these symbols in the sacred text is annihilated by their interpretation, and a meaning so nearly common attached to them that, whosoever or whensoever the invader, in so far as any one of the three designated objects might be disturbed by the invasion, whether of the figurative earth, figurative sea, or figurative rivers, it must needs be that the two others would be thereby disturbed also.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Horae Apocalypticae, Volume 1, an historicist's commentary on the Revelation, updated and revised for the 21st century, derived from the original work of E.B. Eliot, and read by yours truly, Nicholas Arthur. Part 2, Chapter 2, continued. Number 1. Reserving the consideration of the third part for a separate inquiry, let me first ask, what can be the reason for thus setting aside the natural geographical and topographical sense of these expressions, land, sea, rivers? It has arisen, I believe, from an opinion that, whenever any one prominent part of a prophecy is clearly symbolic in its language, the rest ought to be interpreted in a symbolical or figurative sense also. At any rate, in such an example as that now before us, so that in the present instance the land, sea, and rivers mentioned ought to be construed symbolically, because such is clearly the case in regards to the burning mountain, tempest, and meteoric phenomena specified. This opinion, which seems to have prevailed widely among commentators, is evidently of too great importance, and if true, of too extensive application, not to demand an immediate inquiry into its correctness. I have put the question restrictedly, vis-a-vis, as applicable to an example involving local terms, like that before us, because as regards the general question, the mixture of the literal and symbolic is so palpable and so frequent in prophetic scripture that it seems quite needless to detain the reader by citations to prove it. He can scarce open a page in the prophecies without seeing examples. Would any man in his senses suppose that because in Psalm 22 the predictive words, "All my bones are out of joint," and those, "They parted my garments among them," and etc., are to be taken literally, therefore the "fat bulls of Basan" mentioned in connection are to be construed literally also, or vice versa? I believe not an apocalyptic commentator can be found, whatever his predilections in favor of taking all literally or all symbolically, that has been fully able to carry out the rule in practice. It is indeed, in my opinion, all but an impossibility. Thus, it is the limited question of the admissibility of literal localities and a literal geography into prophecies, generally symbolical, that seem alone to need investigation, nor will it detain us long to furnish the proof requisite for an answer in the affirmative. The best proof seems to be that of examples from other prophecies, where the mixture spoken of is unequivocal. Let me here cite a few. My first shall be from Ezekiel 27:26. "The east wind hath broken thee in the midst of the seas." In this passage, Tyre is symbolized as a ship, and Nebuchadnezzar as the destroying wind that shipwrecked it. Yet, symbolical as is the general phraseology, the choreographic phrase, "in the midst of the seas," designates the literal locality of the situation of Tyre. And the east, that of the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar, with respect to it. I rather select this as a first example, because it illustrates the manner in which the locality from whence a threatened evil is to issue is often, by the peculiar appropriate of the emblem, intimated in scripture metaphors, as well as that on which the evil is to fall, that the meaning I have attached to the emblem, as thus significant, is not undersigned or fortuitous, will appear from its frequent and distinctive use elsewhere to the same effect. A second example that I shall cite is from chapter 32 of the same prophecy. Here Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and his people in power are figured under the symbol of a crocodile, after which comes the clause following, "I will water with thy blood the land wherein thou swim, even to the mountains, and the rivers shall be full of thee," of which the meaning is plain. The waters of the Nile being wont to overflow from mountain chain to mountain, which formed the Egyptian valley, and except at flood time, to separate at the delta into many different streams. The prediction made was that these literal rivers, this literal land, should be tinged with the blood of Pharaoh and his people. in which example observe, though the land previously spoken of means the literal land of Egypt, and the rivers its literal rivers, yet the sun, moon, and stars, in the very next verse, use figuratively of its governing authorities, just as is the case of the symbols of the fourth trumpet, as compared with those of the three former. For these are the words of verse 7, "And when I shall have put thee out, i.e. out of the water, I will cover the heaven, and make the stars dark thereof, and will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. All the bright lights of heaven will I make dark over thee, and set darkness upon thy land, saith the Lord." Take a third example from Psalm 88:11. "Thou hast brought a vine out of Egypt. It sent out its boughs into the sea, and its branches into the river," where though the vine is symbolic, yet the Egypt, sea, Mediterranean Sea, and river, Euphrates, are all notoriously literal. Once more, for a case of minuter locality, we may refer to Jeremiah 3:6. "Hast thou seen that which backsliding Israel hath done? She has gone up on every high mountain, and under every green tree, and there hath played the harlot." Here the harlot tree of Judah is figurative, but the high mountains and the green trees indicated the literal localities where that figurative harlotry was committed against God. Thus much on the admixture of the geographically or locally literal with the figurative in the phraseology of other scripture prophecies, to which let me add that in the apocalyptic prophecy itself there are localities specified, as we shall see, both general and particular, which must necessarily be interpreted literally as localities. So, for example, in passages like that of Revelation 12:12, where it is said, "Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for unless the land were the literal land, and the sea the literal island-studded sea, how could they have inhabitants?" And so again in Revelation 9:14, where the Euphrates spoken of must needs mean the literal Assyrian river, supposing only that proof can be given satisfactory, of which I do not doubt that the judgments figured under the sixth trumpet were those of the Turkish woe. Number 2. It remains that while we investigate the meaning of the third part, a question certainly more difficult, it has been mentioned that many commentators interpret the phrase as one designative of the whole Roman world, or perhaps of some large but indefinite portion of it. It is evident, however, that all such indefinite explanation is unsatisfactory, to say nothing of other consistencies in it. It makes one of the most strongly marked phrases of designation in the whole apocalyptic prophecy, one used 7 times here and twice elsewhere. It makes this, I say, altogether without meaning. No wonder that they who thus interpret should be dissatisfied with their own interpretation and show, like Mr. Cunningham, that they have only given it because of not perceiving any threefold division of the Roman world, such as in their opinion to answer to the conditions of the prophetic clause, that the earth or world spoken of in the apocalypse means Roman earth or world, I cannot think be doubted, it being a use of the term frequent in other scriptures, and already proved, I believe elsewhere, to be the true apocalyptic sense. Again, that some actual threefold division of the empire is intended by the phrase third part seems to me also indubitable, just as by that of the four parts of the earth in Seal 4, taking Jerome's reading. The only question is, what? And though it be a question confessedly difficult, yet let it be remembered, it is one on which we do not enter without a hint to aid us, for besides that the famous quadripartite division of the fourth seal may perhaps help to throw light on it, from the fourth trumpet vision exhibiting the third of the sun as eclipse in symbolization of an event, which we saw reason anticipative to regard as the extinction of the Western emperors, the inference follows that whatever were the other two apocalyptic thirds, the Western Empire must needs have been one, indeed the one intended all through the present for visions. And this seems of itself sufficient reason why the natural tripartite division of the Roman world into European, African, and Asiatic, the same that has been suggested as an alternative by Vitringa and subsequently adopted by Mr. Faber and others, should be set aside. For at the time we speak of, the Western Empire, that over which the Goth and Vandal invaders extinguished the Roman government, instead of embracing the whole of the European provinces, agreeably with this natural division, and no more, comprehend in itself only four European provinces, I mean Britain, Gaul, Spain, Italy, and at the same time comprehend the province of Africa. The same objection seems decisive against that political trisection of the empire which was made on the death of Constantine between his three sons, Constans, Constantine, and Constantius, and which other expositors have imagined to be here referred to. For the Western Third then included the provinces of Britain, Gaul, and Spain only, both Italy and the African province being detached from it. Supposing my presumption respecting the Fourth Trumpet Vision's meaning to be correct, it must be regarded as the first essential characteristic of the true trisection intended, that its Western Third, like the Western Empire overwhelmed by the Goths, should comprehend at once the African province, and the four provinces also that have been specified in Europe. And thus we find ourselves forced on another and different trisection of the Roman world, one which shall find to have existed de facto at the precise time to which I refer the first trumpet sounding, and which had been indeed regularly marked out some 80 or 90 years before as a de jure trisection, and on occasion passing, but most notable, alike in history and in the apocalyptic drama. The epic I allude to was that memorable one when Galerius, having died, and Maxentius being drowned in the Tiber, the Roman world found itself under the dominion of the three emperors, Constantine, Licinius, and Maximin, at which time the partitioning of the provinces then fell into the three respectively. To Constantine, we read, there attached Britain, Gaul, Spain, Italy, and Africa. To Licinius, the vast Illyrican prefecture, which coincided with and embraced the rest of Roman Europe. To Maximin, the Asiatic provinces and Egypt. A trisection this, which, in so far as regards the Western Third at least, precisely answers to that indicated by the Fourth Trumpet Vision in the Apocalypse, and there is a direct and striking reference to it at its first forming. In a vision, the subject of which is chronologically anterior to the four trumpets, though in the apocalyptic arrangement, placed supplementary after them, I mean that of the travailing woman and the dragon in chapter 12, where it is said to the dragon that he drew with his tail the third part of the stars of heaven, in reference, if I mistake not, to the then sole representative head of the Roman pagan power, vis-a-vis, in the first instance, Maximin, then Licinius. Hence, altogether, a presumption in favor of this, as the very trisection here intended. No doubt it may be objected that other temporary divisions of the empire followed afterwards, and, more especially that, just before the eruption of the Goths, there was made one too memorable on many accounts in history, and too permanent to be overlooked in the prophecy. I mean, of course, the twofold division into Eastern and Western, first made under Valentinian and Valens, then finally under Theodosius's two sons, Arcadius and Honorius. But the truth is that, considering the matter merely on the de jure principle, the original intermediate Illyrian prefecture will be found to have been so shifted from time to time between the Eastern and the Western Empire that it might seem almost needful, for clearness' sake, that on that account, to preserve a notice of the old tripartite division in which Illyricum held a separate place. And yet more. Considering the matter de facto, it will appear that the era to which the first trumpet is supposed by me to refer, Illyricum was so detached by Gothic occupation from the rule of both the Eastern and Western Empire that its fortunes could not be considered as involved in either, but, for distinctness' sake, needed, absolutely needed, to be considered separately. Already, Illyricum had been the scene of the earliest occupation and devastation of the Goths after the Battle of Adrianople, nor did the peace that they made shortly after with Theodosius cause any effectual alteration in their occupancy of it. The vast regions they had ravaged, says Sismondi, were abandoned to them, if not in absolute sovereignty, yet in terms little at variance with their independence. Thus they already constituted, as it were, a living wall of separation between the two divisions of the empire, which were most properly Roman in their population. More especially, such was the case after Alaric's and the Goths' first revolt on Theodosius's death, and overrunning of the southern part of this same prefecture. Alaric being thereupon constituted master general, or in fact independent prince, of Illyricum. And it was precisely at this epoch, as I conceive, not before, that the first trumpet sounded. Nor indeed was it at this time only that the Illyrian, or intermediate third, was thus separated in its history and fortunes from the other two-thirds. The same continued the case afterwards. In the 6th and 7th centuries, the Bulgarian power was formed, and the result was that first the Avar, then the Bulgarian dominion, intruded into it, and Mesia, during the Middle Ages, was broken into the barbarian kingdoms of Servia and Bulgaria. In the 9th century, Macedonia and the eastern Illyricum were inundated by Sclavonic hordes, which, whom even the whole southern Peloponnesus is said to have been scandalized, and which were not thus in language only, but also in government, very much separated from the Greek Empire. Finally, and much later, the Franks in their crusading expeditions severed the southernmost of the Illyrian provinces from the Greeks, and long occupied them. I the rather mention this last act in tracing the distinct and separate history of the Illyrian prefecture, because it carries us down to the times of the Turks, and shows how properly that selfsame tripartite division of which we have spoken was used even under the sixth trumpet in the prophecy, seeing that it was but the third of men, the eastern third, against whom the slaying commission of the Euphrates horsemen could be properly said to be given. Thus the result of our investigation has been to show that, on general grounds, and with reference to the general tenor of Roman history, at and subsequent to the time of the Gothic invasion, instead of the tripartite division that I speak of being a division inappropriate to make use of in the prophetic prefiguration of those events and times, because of the notable bipartition of the empire into Eastern and Western that had taken place a little previously, it was precisely the most appropriate that could be chosen, and this the rather because of its having been framed from Diocletian's memorable quadripartition, noted in the 4th seal, by the union into one of the Italian and Gallic imperial prefectures. It only remains to see whether it will suit the details of the 3 first trumpet visions, as we have already, by anticipation, seen that it does those of the 4th. And when we shall have completed the comparison of these details with the details of the history corresponding, I trust that on this point the reader will find himself equally satisfied.
The book of Revelation says, "The spirit of prophecy is the testimony of Jesus Christ,
This is at the very heart of FirstAmendmentRadio.com. In that spirit, we have created the Prophecy Reality News app for all of your mobile devices, streaming First Amendment Radio 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, available for your Apple, Android device, and smartphone absolutely free. Get the Prophecy Reality News app installed today, so you can listen to First Amendment Radio wherever you are. The Prophecy Reality News app. Get it now.